This is Colonel Sweeney, tape one.
I joined the army in September 1939 as a militiaman, having been called up under the Hall Militia Act in the previous June. I didn't realize when I was called up that I was going to stay in the army for longer than 6 months, because that was the period. But in fact, by the time I joined, the war had just started, and I stayed for 35 years. I joined initially, I was put into the pay corps because I was a student when I was called up, and this was considered to be a reasonable place to put me. But I very quickly managed to transfer to the infantry, and I went to the Manchester Regiment where I did my recruit training. I then went to a machine gun octu because the Manchester Regiment were a machine gun regiment. I was commissioned into the Northumberland Fusiliers. There were far too many officers in that regiment, so I transferred to the Oxfordshire and Buckinghamshire Light Infantry and stayed with them thereafter. I joined the 2nd Battalion, which was an airborne battalion, gliders, and I took part in the coup de main operation on Pegasus Bridge the night before D-Day, when my platoon landed on the River Bridge. And then I stayed in Normandy until I was wounded in the July. I came back to the United Kingdom. I then took part in the Rhine crossing operation in the March of 45. And then after that, we reached the Baltic at Wismar. We were brought back to England. The rest of my career was, I then served in Palestine and Egypt for 2 to 3 years. I went to the Army Staff College. I went to Berlin as a grade 2 staff officer. I came back and rejoined my regiment in the Canal Zone. I then went to the United States Staff College at Fort Leavenworth. Then I went to Canada on a posting for 2 years in Winnipeg. Then I came back and rejoined my regiment and went to Cyprus. I then came back to the United Kingdom and went to the War Office and the Military Operations Branch for 3 years. I then took command of my regiment, which by this time had been renamed and was now the 1st Battalion, the Royal Green Jackets. Took them out to Malaya and subsequently took part in the Brunei and Borneo confrontations.
Start again. Could you just say, took part in the Brunei? You said Brunei.
Yes.
Could you just say Brunei again?
I went to Malaya and subsequently took part in the Brunei operation and the Borneo confrontation. Then I came back to the Ministry of Defense. After that, I went to the United Nations as the military advisor to our permanent delegation in New York when Lord Carradine was the ambassador there and was there during the Arab-Israeli War of 1967. And then I came back to the United Kingdom. I went to the British Army of the Rhine as head of public army relations and then went to the School of Infantry as deputy commandant, from where I retired in 1974. After I'd retired, I had a bit of a holiday, and then I took over the command of the Dogs Home Battersea, which had been in the hands of a naval commander for the last 20 years. Everything was painted steel grey, I remember, when I arrived there. And I often say that instead of commanding a unit of 640 soldiers, I commanded a unit of 600 dogs and 40 or 50 staff. But the procedures were much the same. You still carry out your morning inspection. You still get your parade state. But instead of A Company being on the range and B Company being on a route march, you find how many dogs have come in and how many dogs have gone out and which are sick and which have to be put down. But it's been a very fulfilling period because the public are terribly kind to a charity such as the Dogs Home Battersea, and you do meet everybody from the peers of the realm to the gypsies who are coming in trying to get a Lurcher dog for nothing. I've been there for 14 years. I'm just retiring. Halfway through my career, I took over a new establishment, which was a country annex at Old Windsor, which has a kennel-maid training school and a commercial kennels. But still continue to supervise the running of the Dogs Home Battersea. At the end of the war, after we had finished our time in the fight against the Nazis, we were brought back to England to go to the Far East. But of course the atom bomb was dropped, and we had a month when we didn't know where we were going to go. And then the division I was in, which was the 6th Airborne Division, was switched to Palestine. Now, during the war, you hadn't been told a word of this. You were told how to shoot and kill and defeat the enemy. But here we were told that this was not to be the situation in Palestine. We were to be very careful. We had to use minimum force. If we were confronted by an angry mob, we had to put up a banner. If we felt that we had to shoot, you had to fire aimed rounds. And everything was quite different. But we did have a number of study periods, which were run by brigade and divisional headquarters, on how to deal with this new situation, this imperial policing or aid to the civil power. We went to Gaza, and I think I'm quite correct in saying that our sympathy at that time laid with the Jewish population, because we had, after all, gone through Germany. Many of us had seen the Buchenwald, which was very close to our route across Germany. Some of our soldiers had gone in there and had come back. Belsen, I know, I had an officer go there who came back and told me all about it. And so we were very sympathetic towards the Jews. But I'm also afraid that it was quite clear that within 6 months we had found our feelings of sympathy towards the Jews more or less completely alienated by their behavior towards the British troops. And we had, as I say, arrived there very proud of our red beret and the fact that we were combat troops, only to be told within a few months that we were exactly the same as the SS by people like Menachem Begin, who had been who had come out of Poland and had had some dealings with the SS. And this wasn't very satisfactory to us. We went to Gaza, where we were given some training, and then we eventually went up near Tel Aviv, and nothing very much happened. It was all fairly quiet until about the October of 1945, when a certain amount of trouble started. By this time, we'd got to a camp called Camp 22, which was halfway between Haifa and Tel Aviv. And there, we were given the usual type of internal security duties. First of all, you had to guard your own camp and make sure that you weren't attacked. This was something quite new to us, because in England you never bothered much to guard your barracks. But we took this very seriously. And as you know, a lot of people were attacked about this time, largely because they were still living in the peacetime atmosphere. Now, I have no great knowledge of being involved in any serious operations or fighting in Palestine. Most of my memory of Palestine is of a reasonably peaceful time there. We were very careful that whenever we went out, we carried arms, and we went in at least 2 vehicles. We didn't take chances. We were very well schooled in looking after ourselves. And in fact, during the whole of our 2 to 3 years in Palestine, we never had any casualties which were caused by the terrorists. We had soldiers who were killed by accidents, not many of them, and we had our post truck, which you might say was perhaps a vulnerable vehicle, was blown up by a mine, but the post corporal, I know, wasn't injured, because I still see him to this day. He lives not very far away from here. So we really did not suffer at all. And I think in many cases, the people who suffered the casualties were not the infantry, but were the RASC, who were driving the vehicles, the clerks who lived in headquarters that might be blown up, the police stations which were attacked. But when people talk about how terrible and ghastly it all was in Palestine, that is not my memory of it. It obviously wasn't a very nice situation from the political point of view, but from the military point of view, we had quite happy days sunbathing ourselves and swimming in the sea and so on. I believe that our feelings towards our own government and towards the government of Palestine and towards the trouble out there were largely based on our personal domestic situation. Now, most of us had fought the war in Europe, and when everybody else was coming home from the Far East and from Germany and so on and being released, here we found ourselves having been sent out on a 3-year tour in the Middle East. I think we were quite happy to leave Palestine, and we certainly didn't leave it with any feeling that there was going to be a war between the two groups, which would go on for many years. Most of us, I felt that there could have been a reasonable solution under the British, and that the British plans, which were to try and have a joint government composed of Arabs and Jews under some sort of mandate, High Commissioner, and then gradually hand over control to the people who lived in the country, was the right way of doing it. Now, of course, what happened was the pressure from the United States and the outside world was too great. The British were allowing in, I think, 1,500 Jewish immigrants only a month. This wasn't good enough for the Americans particularly, who brought pressure to bear on Ernest Bevin, who eventually rather washed his hands of the whole affair and said, well, here you are, here's the newly formed United Nations, you solve this problem. We're damned if we're going to start losing more lives trying to solve a problem in which we're not really very interested. And I think that was the feeling of those on the ground, that there was no real reason why it shouldn't have been able to be solved by the people there. Now, from time to time, the troops did get angry. For example, when the King David was blown up, I happened to be the officers' club in the King David had a bar, and I happened to have been there on the Sunday before it was blown up, leaning up against the wall where the milk churns were parked, and if one had been there on the Monday, one would have been blown up with the rest. And that was thought to be particularly stupid thing to do, because most of the people who were killed were in fact the Jewish clerks who worked for the British headquarters. When the two sergeants were hanged, I think they were either intelligence or military police sergeants, were caught at a village, and their bodies were found hanged, and they were not only hanged, but their bodies were booby-trapped. This caused a revulsion of feeling against whoever had done it, whether it was Ergun or Stern or the Haganah, one doesn't recall now. So there was this feeling from time to time against the rather bloody incidents which were carried out by the Jewish terrorists, but generally speaking, there wasn't any feeling against the normal Jewish population. Nevertheless, we all felt that it could have been solved quite amicably if the two groups had only worked together, and if there hadn't been this outside pressure to push more and more Jews into Palestine. But of course, this was the result of the war, as we now know. We didn't at that point know this. We didn't know that there were thousands and thousands of Jews who were waiting to find their way out of Europe. And so we couldn't understand why all this fuss about pushing in more and more illegal immigrants in leaky boats should happen. We used to patrol the coast, and now and again we caught the odd group, usually just about the point where they were all dispersing. Your patrol would catch the last two or three people. And we guarded Athlete Transit Camp, where they put a number of these Jewish people while they were deciding what to do with them. So we realized that the problem was due to the influx of the Jews, and of course then you got the reaction from the Arabs. But the United Nations came in and made the plan for the partition of Palestine, and we left quite happily feeling, well, that settled the problem. They'll now all live happily ever after. And they've each got their territory. They don't seem to be able to get on, so they've been separated. It's the age-old business of partition is supposed to be the answer to all these problems. It didn't work in Ireland. It didn't work in Palestine. It didn't work in Cyprus. It's never worked, but at the time, it's a let-out. And this seemed to be the answer to the problem here. The only serious incident that affected me personally, and it wasn't all that serious, was that we were in Jerusalem towards the end of our stay in 1947, when by this time the situation had changed considerably to when we'd first got there. When we first went to Jerusalem, we walked up and down the Via Dolorosa and the various streets without any thought of insecurity. By this time, of course, they had produced zones, and these zones were guarded by barbed wire, and the entrance to the zones were manned by soldiers. And so outside the zones, you only went out in groups, but inside the zones, you could walk fairly freely. And one of the areas that was very difficult was the Meir Shareem quarter, which is near a place called the Syrian Orphanage. And I had the company that was guarding that, and we had in it what we called the lightning platoon. Now, the idea was that when an incident occurred, your platoon in three vehicles went racing out and went to the area of the incident, cordoned the whole of the area off, and this would mean that anybody in there wouldn't be able to get out, and so the police could then come along and in slow time could investigate the incident and search the houses. So one night, the alarm went off, and our lightning platoon, which had a white armoured scout car in as the leading vehicle with a sandbagged floor, went racing out of the front gate, followed by another vehicle. The alarm had gone off because a vehicle had been blown up somewhere nearby. As the lightning platoon went racing out, it went down another road, not the road where the incident had occurred, so as to get around to the back of the incident. It got about 300 yards when it too was blown up. A police car coming down a third road towards our headquarters was also blown up. So clearly the terrorists had blocked every exit and every avenue to where they knew this platoon would come from. Luckily, because of the sandbagging of the white scout car, there were no casualties. And the police vehicle, the person wasn't too badly hit. But this was the sort of thing, by this time they were deliberately trying to cause casualties. But this was, as I must point out, getting on towards the end of the period that we were there, and long after the first UN party had visited and made their report. And that was it. We didn't have anybody seriously injured. Two or three went to hospital. But as a result of this banging, the roofs of all the buildings in Jerusalem were manned by the Arab Legion, or one of these paramilitary forces, who were very trigger-happy. And one of them fired, which was immediately responded by somebody on another roof firing back. And so a gun battle then went on for about 20 minutes. And I think they found out afterwards that it was entirely a gun battle between the security forces. Nobody was hurt. There was a tremendous rattle of firing went on. So this was the sort of thing. It was a jittery type of situation, but being in this particularly difficult quarter, the Meir Shareem quarter, we always went out in double convoys. Nobody ever went out on foot unless it was a patrol, and we didn't suffer any casualties. I think the main lesson one learned from Palestine was that you had to learn that we were no longer in a wartime situation. You had to make the transition from a wartime situation to a peacetime situation. And you had to learn that some of the methods that were quite acceptable in war, if you went on a patrol and you met the enemy, you shot them. Well, if you went on a patrol and you came across somebody who might be a terrorist, you couldn't just shoot them out of hand. You had to try and capture them and bring them back. So I think that was the biggest difficulty, was trying to bring ourselves from a wartime situation where you were fighting and living in slit trenches and all the time on the alert, into a peacetime situation where you were living in normal peacetime conditions, yet you were still at war with terrorists. And yet the methods you used to deal with them had to be quite different to the methods you used to deal with the Nazis, with the Germans. I don't want to give the impression that life in Palestine was grim and hard. We had an opportunity to visit all the holy places in the old city when we first got there. I went across to Jerash, the Roman city in Jordan. I visited Amman. I went all the way down to Petra, the rose-red city half as old as time. And we had many opportunities to enjoy ourselves and go bathing, but from time to time the situation would get bad and then we would have to tighten up our internal security. But that was an example where the intelligence was very quickly followed up, and I think one of the big problems was that the intelligence was gained at far too high a level. By the time it came down to the operational troops, it was too late. Now, there were other incidents that occurred. I remember there was a major called Major Frost who'd been at Bruneval and who later was Colonel Frost on the Bridge at Arnhem. And his wife now was out there with the wagon that supplied the troops with tea. She wasn't his wife at that time, but she was caught up in a gun battle at Sarafand, which was the British headquarters not far from Tel Aviv, and got shot in the tummy. So you see, it wasn't that it was just the soldiers that were caught up in these incidents. It sometimes hit the civilians, even the British civilians. I think that's all I've got to say on that. My regiment was sent to Cyprus in August, September 1956. Now, we had been stationed in Germany. I had just rejoined them, having had an overseas tour in the United States and Canada, and we were going to Hong Kong. But in early August of 1956, NASA seized the canal, and we were very swiftly we had our plans changed very swiftly. And instead of going to Hong Kong, to which, by the way, some of our advance parties had already gone by air to arrive there, instead of going to Hong Kong, we were told we would go to Cyprus. There was a great deal of re-equipping for this operation, and also calling back to the colours some reservists, because reservists were called up. And the idea was, I think, we thought the idea was anyway, that we would go to Cyprus and then take part in some sort of operation to try and regain control of the canal. We sailed from Southampton in the August on a troop ship with another battalion, the battalion of the Cheshire Regiment, and we were very tightly packed onto this troop ship. But to me, it was the last time when I marched through the streets of England at the dead of night down to the railway station, got on the train, and then detrained at Southampton, got on the ship, and as we sailed out of Southampton waters, the crowds were lining the cliff tops, and there was a feeling of the wartime situation coming back. I think you had it again at the time of the Falklands when people saw the troops off, but that was the final time, as far as I'm concerned, when we had this old-fashioned business of sailing off to war with the band playing and the crowds cheering you. We arrived in Cyprus 10 days later and disembarked and were put into two schools near Nicosia under the most ghastly and appalling conditions. I rather got the impression that the Cyprus authorities, who had had the EOKA problem going on for a few years, were rather taken aback by the number of additional troops that were suddenly poured into the country. We lived in these appalling conditions for about 2 or 3 weeks. In the heat of the summer, it was one of the driest and hottest summers they've had. And then we went into a camp which was set off on a bit of open ground with nothing except one water pipe, and gradually got ourselves organized. There wasn't any actual trouble going on, but I think our experience in Palestine and Egypt, and there were a lot of people who were in the regiment at that time who'd been in both those places, made us realize that we would have much the same sort of situation. And so we very quickly adopted the methods of security and safeguarded ourselves as we had done in these other two Middle Eastern countries. The first task we had was to carry out a cordon and search of a village, which was a pretty innocuous sort of thing. There wasn't much information again, and we didn't really catch anybody. And I got the impression that the Cyprus situation, as opposed to the end of the Palestinian situation was not very well organized, not very well controlled. But this didn't seem, from our point of view, from a soldier's point of view, it did not seem that this had much effect on the government. The government had just, I think, at this time, come under the control of Field Marshal Harding, and they were still pretty lackadaisical in many ways. It was only over the next 2 years that they got better and better and better. And again, you're up against the same old problem of poor intelligence. Now, in this case, of course, the reason was that very few British people spoke good colloquial Greek. And again, I think I'm right in saying that many of the members of Special Branch and so on in the administration had been Greeks who spoke the language, and they, of course, were either terrorized into not acting in their capacity as interpreters and linguists and intelligence agents, or they were actively working against the British. So, again, you had this big problem that you couldn't get the intelligence. And I think on that, we'll just leave it at that point, shall we?
Well, I forgot to warn you about the winding down. Yeah.
While you're doing that, would it be a good idea if I got a cup of tea or a cup of coffee?